You've heard me talk about Morning Kick, used by former karate champion Chuck Norris. It's a daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes similar to strawberry lemonade, and I enjoy it. I know I don't eat as many vegetables as I should, but Morning Kick has helped me make up for that, and I feel great. I have more energy and better digestion. It's an easy part of my morning routine. My wife started taking it as well. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris today. We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. Hope everyone's doing well on this beautiful Monday morning. At least it is where I am. Andrew, is it beautiful where you are?
Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
Your mug says Minnesota. Or
yes,
looks like Minnesota.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That says you betcha. Yeah, it's beautiful here. It's one of the, you know, handful of beautiful days we have here. It's about to be frigid cold in like a month. So,
are you in like northern Minnesota or?
No, I'm in southern Minnesota. It's extreme northern Iowa, really. And cornfields everywhere. But it gets cold quick, and so we're enjoying it. You know, I'll maybe go golfing later today.
When I'm in the Midwest, the weather can change so drastically. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah.
Like you can have like a warm day and the next day it's snowing. And so anyway,
for real. Yeah.
So I should probably mention for those who are, I have a shirt on. It says all you can see is vegetarian. So I should probably just clarify to everyone. It says it's actually an anti-vegetarian shirt, but
they're vegetarian.
They're vegetarian. So you don't have to be. So anyway, we have Andrew Iskar on the podcast today to talk about his latest book, The Boniface Option. And of course, the first book you published was the book with Torba or Andrew Torba on Christian nationalism, right?
That's correct.
So this is your second book?
This is my second, my first one. That's just me. Kind of my second, kind of my first, you know? Yeah.
So you are a Christian nationalist. You are the person that everyone's mad at that they want to. You
know. Yeah, I guess so. I guess I am. Here I am.
You started this whole thing because that was before Stephen's book that you published that book.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen, he had his in development for a very long time because it's a huge book. Ours, we worked on quickly because we knew, it was the 2022 election year and that topic was becoming a big one. They were attacking all sorts of different candidates, like where Torba lives in Pennsylvania. Doug Mastriano was running for governor, and they're saying he's a Christian nationalist because he would have like a flag lapel pin, and he would say very basic Christian statements. Well, I believe in Jesus, and I believe America was a Christian nation, and that's good. And they're like, he's horrible. This is a theocrat trying to take over the country. And so you had all of these, this whole cast of characters like Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead and all of these clowns, academics who were attacking, writing all these books attacking it, and so we saw this going on. And we said, well, I believe this stuff. I believe that America was a Christian nation, was founded by Christians, and that was good. And it's good if we go back to that. And so we need to write in defense of it, stand up for what we believe in. And so we put the book together. We wrote it, very quickly. That was the first book we'd ever done. And of course we were attacked because, we didn't understand all the nuances of typesetting and all of those things. But we got it out and really just tried to reinforce very basic Christian understanding of politics, of what it means to be a Christian and engage in politics and have laws influenced by the Bible and by Christian teaching. And, it was funny because it's not like you read it and the book itself was not very, it's like Stephen's book. It's not actually all that controversial. Stephen's book was just a 400-page exposition of Protestant political theory that has existed for hundreds of years. And ours was really defense of Christian America and it, not controversial in any, real sense, but people still attacked it and hated it and went crazy. And so, you know, and it did well. And I think it did well because we captured that particular moment when the battle lines were kind of being set. And you still see that, you know, now a year later, people still don't exactly know what to make of it. They think, I mean, you have some people like, oh, this is just a flash in the pan. This is like the emergent church and it's going to go away. And I'm like, well, Christian America has existed for, you know, 400 years. It's not going away. I mean, it's much smaller and it's almost a remnant now, but it's not going to just die out, this idea, this thinking. Some of the stuff we wanted to do, cause you would have the kind of like the Michael Flynn version of Christian nationalism where, you know, or the Mike Lindell one, where you have these guys that aren't, you know, they aren't very theologically adept. Like they don't know, very serious Christian doctrine. It's kind of a mishmash of boomer evangelicalism, charismatic kind of stuff. And then there is this really weird thing. Like you have Flynn like a month or two ago saying we need to put down the Bible and pick up the Constitution or something like that. And it's like, what? No, man, that's not what we need to do. So you have that side of it where it's not very sophisticated. It's just, we like Jesus and we like America and it isn't that, well thought out. But then you have other guys like us and certainly like Stephen and many others who are thinking through the more deeper, intellectual aspects of what these things really mean. And so that has a lot more staying power, I think, than just kind of this flash in the pan thing that they think it is. So yeah, that's what we are. You know, we're unabashed and it's like, I don't really want a label. I don't really want to have this label of Christian nationalist because it's not a label I have always carried. But in the back of my head, it's what I believed for my entire life as a Christian. And that's one of the things too. It's like, why do you take a name that your enemies made? And I'm like, well, that's pretty common throughout Christian history. Like even like Protestant is a name that like Martin Luther and John Calvin didn't come up with the name Protestant. That's a name their enemies gave them. Same thing with like Puritans, right? That was a slur that was used against them. So I don't have any problem with saying, yeah, okay, yeah, we are Christian nationalists. Sure, great, cool. We're kind of in the crosshairs with it a little bit, but my main goal and Torba's main goal was just to defend decent, regular Christian people that don't want to see their nation burned up and want it to be a faithful Christian place again.
Yeah. And you are a pastor, just so people understand where this is all coming from as we dive into your new book. So you're writing for, I would assume, people in your people in your congregation. So Christians who, are well-meaning and want the basics of what you just described, a Christian understanding, honoring Christian values, that kind of thing. But maybe they don't know exactly in the confusion of the media circus where to turn, how to think through it. And so you're providing some resources for them as a pastor. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, there really was nothing. All you have is the media constantly saying this is wrong and bad and evil, and you're probably racist, and you're probably really bad people. And what we wanted was, because we would go on Amazon, you type in Christian nationalism on Amazon before August of 2022, and it would just be all these books and things that would say how bad these people are and how they're evil and how they hate democracy and they're subverting our democracy and so forth. And it's like, well, I want people to, you know, who are normal and regular, decent Christian folks to not be beat over the head constantly and be able to stand up for themselves and say, no, I believe this and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Right. And so it's a really defense of our people to be able to say, no, there's nothing wrong with you at all. This is normal. This is stuff that everybody, I mean, even like 100 years ago, I mean, you have these like proclamations that FDR of all people would make that say, well, you know, during World War II, that America is a Christian nation. We should pray for the military as they're out for at war, and like this long thing. And it's like, that was FDR saying that. I mean, the guy's like, yeah, you know, all but a communist. And so now, you know, every, what was normal and just universal across the board in America is being treated as this very fringe, very radical, crazy, out there thing. And it's not. I want people to, you know, one of my influences, one of the guys that influenced me a lot, man that I studied under, Pastor Doug Wilson. One of the things he constantly says is assuming the center, right? Just assuming the center. And really what that means is, no, we're the normal ones. We're not crazy. All of you are. You're the radicals. You're the insane people. We are the normal ones, and teaching people and giving people resources to be able to assume the center like that. To say, no, this is normal. This is fine. You guys are the crazy one.
So let me ask you this. But I know we haven't even gotten into your new book yet, which I obviously that's the title of this podcast, and that's why what I want to do. But I can't really help myself. I'm going. We'll see what happens. I'm planning on calling G3 Ministries later today and seeing if I can have a conversation with Josh Bice. We'll see how that goes. Really, there's two things I think that I want to try to see if I can just navigate with him, and that one is, is there any way it might be too late of an hour, but is there any way that we can figure out like have a listening session or just like actually talk to each other? In other words, people who criticize Christian nationalists who are Christians and then people who take the label Christian nationalists. So that's one of the things. And then the other thing is to try to figure out why he thinks that I've spread lies and slander about him or whatever. And I don't see it. I don't know what he's referring to exactly. So I want to address those things with him. And I've told people in the last 2 weeks that I'm going to give a little bit more of the inside baseball that people, because people are really curious. Why is there this disagreement between people that we respect and we thought they were on the mm-hmm. same team? They were both, we thought, against social justice. And then you have, mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of evangelicals. Josh is just one of them, but there's a whole bunch of them that are freaking out. In my opinion, or at least their rhetoric looks like they're freaking out in the same way the media does, using the same thing, mm-hmm. saying that mm-hmm. This is going to eliminate civil liberties. And I mean, even mocking, you know, where's the, do you want a Protestant Pope, even suggesting that kind of thing? I mean, there's been so many things said, you know, trying to make Michael Flynn or King George or not King George, sorry. I'm blinking on the name of the King of England. Help me out here.
Charles.
Charles, yeah. Thank you.
Thank yeah, you. Yeah, yeah.
I'm still in Revolutionary War mindset.
That's right.
Making King Charles the face of Christian nationalism. Like, there's been these things that are, they're, most of them I think we see, and you're laughing, we laugh. That's silly. Yeah. That's not.
But they're serious and sincere when they say
they're serious. Yeah. And they do see racism under the hood. They do see all these things the media also sees. And I don't see it. I don't. I've read your book. I've read Stephen's book. In fact, one of the local pastors who happens to be a conservative Episcopalian, if you can believe it, very well versed on at least like church tradition. He read Stephen's book and he said, I don't understand why this is controversial. This is pretty much just like what Christians have said for hundreds of years. But now it is. So I would just curious if you could like address that. Just say like, why do you think, we know what the media is up to. The media's always been up to the same thing. Why do you think though that there's prominent Christian ministries taking such shots? Gospel Coalition, G3 Ministries. I don't know. The list goes on. They're trying to discredit it in the same ways in many instances the media does. Why is there that, you know, you think there's that lack of communication, that lack of trying to understand, and that just kind of like that lashing out? That's what it seems like to me. And then do you think there's any merit to charges of like, well, Christian nationalists are going to get rid of free speech. They're going to erode civil liberties. They're going to restrict immigration to the point that, or now I guess Owen Strand is suggesting that there's kinism is lurking in the background here. So
yeah.
I know it's supposed to be about your new book, but I'd really, no, that's what is
I mean,
on people's
they play,
minds. So
they play into each other. And I talk about some of this stuff in the new book too. So it's okay. but what I think is, you know, what drives a lot of this is that we, you know, since 2015, well, even backing up there, like in America, since the Second World War, there has been, you know, sort of a political and cultural consensus, in particular after, you know, the Civil Rights Revolution in the 1950s and 60s, there's been a cultural consensus of this is what everybody thinks. And anything outside of this, you know, to quote like Tom Woods, the 3x5 card of allowable opinion, anything outside of that is dangerous and bad and very scary. So you can't go there. And so all of the things that everybody believes from, you know, 1945 onward, is, you know, both, you know, liberals and conservatives, they all believe that liberal democracy, egalitarian liberal democracy is sacrosanct, right? That it's inviolable, that we can't have any criticisms of it. We can't say that here's some problems with this system. And so all of the aspects of it, right? That I think is part of it, where, I mean, if you think like I do, like, I don't know if you've, maybe you have on your show talked about, Christopher Caldwell's book, Age of Entitlement, where it really gets into just how radical a departure from the constitutional Republican norms that we had, that really it was a new constitution that was created in the 1960s over civil rights, where you don't get gay marriage, you don't get trans stuff, all the insanity that we have today without that being codified into law in the 1960s, because it's all based around civil rights law that these things are happening. And so he backs up and says, well, this is the new constitution that supersedes the existing one. And so I think a lot of it is that, where now after 2015 and 2016, after Trump comes onto the scene, and it shook things up so much that people began to seriously reevaluate the entire project of what we have had, this globalist system, and ask some very uncomfortable questions, at least uncomfortable for people in the mainstream, of, well, what if we don't have infinity immigration anymore? What if we have a nation that actually pursues the interests of its people and what's good for them, and not what's good for, you know, ginormo corporations? What would that look like? And so you like genuine right-wing thought has made its way onto the scene, like the type of thinking that you'd only find with guys among the paleoconservatives in the 90s, like Pat Buchanan and Sam Francis and Paul Gottfried. That has now entered, it's not in the mainstream yet, but it's much further away from the fringe, much closer to the mainstream than anybody's comfortable with. And so I think they're very threatened by that. And some of it plays into also, and I bring this up in the new book, I think Ayn Rand's three-world paradigm is so crucial, so important to understand, not just things going on in evangelicalism, but really things going on in the culture in general. And so any listeners that aren't familiar with that, I can explain it. It is, you know, you have positive world, neutral world, and negative world. And positive world was the time period where in American society, where people viewed Christians positively. Like if you're going to apply for a job and they knew, okay, you go to church every Sunday, you're a faithful Christian, that's a good guy. I like that guy. I want to hire him to work. Like, I'm going to trust. I have a positive view of him. I'll be willing to grant him a lot more trust than I would for other people. Things like that, where just the view of Christianity was very generally very, very positive. And that lasted until like the 90s, you know.
Well, just one illustration of that. Someone showed me a document the other day that I thought blew me away in New York City. And it was from like the 1930s or something. It was required, I guess certain people required it that you had to get a recommendation from your pastor. Your pastor had to literally sign
on a lease. If you were going to rent an apartment or something, you needed a vouching for you who had a man of the cloth, as they say. So that was New York City.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane to think about.
Yeah, I know.
Not that long ago.
Less than 100 years ago. And so that really kind of withered away in the 1990s. So by the 1990s, within Ren's paradigm, you entered something called neutral world, where the positive view of Christians wasn't there. It was an intellectual curiosity. It was like, oh, you're a Christian. That's cool. I like to collect stamps. You know, like it's treated like you're a member of the Lions Club or the Rotary. Like it's not neither good nor bad, right? It's just a thing that you do. And so that really lasted from the early to mid 90s until about 2015, I think is really the, Obergefell is really the clear jumping off point. And that's where, guys like Tim Keller and a lot of, the modern evangelicalism really made their hay. I mean, or even Rick Warren, all the mega church growth stuff made its hay during neutral world, where the culture isn't necessarily actively hostile, although in a few places in larger cities, maybe it was. It was more or less ambivalent. And that's within that kind of cultural paradigm, that's how they understood everything. And that's where like winsomeness and all of that kind of stuff came in. Cause it's like, well, they don't view us negatively. So if we show how winsome and good and respectable and decent and kind people we are, that's what's going to be the thing that wins them to us. Right. And so to be, fair to those people, that largely worked. I mean, there's a reason why Tim Keller had massive success in Manhattan, because that was appealing to that segment of the population. And now, after Obergefell, we are in negative world, where the culture actively takes a dislike to Christians and views them negatively. Like, if you are an evangelical Christian, you're some kind of weird religious freak, right? You see this on like a television show like The Office. They had the evangelical Christian character Angela, and she's this nasty, vindictive woman, and nobody likes her, and she's really, really petty. And she's the evangelical Christian in the show, right? That's kind of how they look at us, or at least early in negative world. Now it's like, you are the devil. You're evil. You are a hater. You're a bigot. You are the scum of the earth now, if you're a Christian. And so a lot of evangelicalism, big evangelicalism, is not adapted to that at all. They're still in the neutral world paradigm. And even the guys who are a little bit more to the right than the Kellers and so forth, your G3 type of guys, like they still are living in neutral world, right? They still really think that the globalist liberal project works, and it's if not morally neutral, it's a positive moral good. Democracy is great, and pluralism is great, and we can live in that world. I mean, some of it is theological too. I mean, if you have this, it sort of fits in with a Baptist view of politics, where you want to have pluralism, because creeping around the corner are these guys who are going to drown Baptists if we let them get power, and so that's like baked into the cake for them. But some of it too is just cultural, that they are terrified of something that overturns the apple cart, that is outside the realm of allowable opinion, outside the Overton window, and it's very scary to them. So in terms of, right, why are they, like you say, freaking out? And I think they are too. The rhetoric is just so over the top, like Owen Strain especially, like just totally over the top. Why are they doing that? I think it's two things. It's one, the guys like me or Stephen Wolf and others are gaining an audience, like people, you too, people are listening to what we have to say. And it's like that conservative Episcopalian pastor, they read the stuff that Stephen writes or I write, and they're like, I don't get what the fuss is about. This is pretty reasonable. Right. These arguments are sound. They make sense. These are not wackos. they're saying things that I agree with. And that I think is what terrifies them, because our arguments are good and sound and they comport with reality. They comport with the actual situation as it exists today. Because like people see like the whole globalist system is fracturing. And you know, regardless of whatever happens with Trump, and whatever, I mean, 2024 is going to be, it's going to make 2020 look like nothing. It's going to make it look like the halcyon days of lore. You know, like I think it's going to be the most insane year we've lived through. So that's my prediction right now. I mean, I think my predictions are probably better than James Lindsay's, who thought we were going to have a trans George Floyd this summer. It's like he's just always wrong. He's kind of like the Bill Kristol of predictions online, you know.
He does fit into what you're talking about, even with these evangelicals and these media types who are freaking out. Like there's this level 10 threat, and it's not really a level 10 threat. It's not what they think it is necessarily, so they overplay it, and you know, put themselves in the position of opposing it, which I suppose should gain them some credibility or some you know, accolades or something.
I think some of that too, though. Oh yeah, sorry. I think some of that too, though, is they like wokeness is petering out. Like people, like you could see it with the Target stuff and the Bud Light stuff and everything like that. That they're having to dial it back because of the reaction from the populace to these things.
Right.
And so that threat is kind of, I mean, even with the presidential campaign, like that's DeSantis's big issue where he really. Made his name for himself, and that's kind of over. And so you see him on the debate stage and he's got really nothing else to really distinguish himself from all the other also rans running for president. And so I think that stuff's petering out. So what do? They have to find some other threat. They have to find, okay, now it's the far right that is the scary one. And in a lot of ways, in one sense, they're right. Because there hasn't been like genuine rightism in America since before the First World War or Second World War. They're like the old conservative, the old right was the last instance of it. And after World War II, the neocons basically won, right? They basically took over conservatism, their view of foreign policy, their view of really everything. And just pushed down the old right. Like National Review purged all the paleocons in the 90s, the guys that I mentioned. Yeah. And now it's come back right now. Like, I mean, the podcast that I do with CJ Engel are, I think, still our most watched episode. And it's still a very small podcast. Our most watched episode, even more than when we had you on. It was a very popular episode, was with Paul Gottfried. This 80-year-old guy, right? And everyone's like, oh, I can't wait to hear what he has to say. And so he's having kind of a renaissance, you know, in his old age. Everybody wants to have Paul Gottfried on because it's coming back because people see that stuff is falling apart completely, that there are no answers, that you're not going to get an answer from typical standard conservatism about the real problems that we face. And people want the truth. And so it's growing. It's getting a lot bigger. And so they see this threat. They see this threat to their ministries because, you know, people are starting to wake up to what is actually occurring, what is actually going on, the world that we live in. We could get into this with my book because that's really what I focus on, is just how insane our world is currently today. It's just a total fiction. I mean, I try not to, you know, overuse the Matrix analogy. But it's like that. I mean, it's a fantasy world that people live in that's manufactured, and people have to break out of that. So anyway, I cut you off and I went on a long tangent.
No, it's all good. Anyway. It's great. We've been going almost half an hour. It's funny. We haven't even gotten to your new book really.
I know.
which I want to do. I want to pivot and start talking about that. But the only thing I was going to say is, like, if you take the long view of this, it seems like there's the left is, they're egalitarians, and so they want to flatten everything, make everything equal. They idolize that. Their whole diversity push is part of that. to try to deplatform, decenter who they view as those, you know, white people who have too much power, white men specifically. And if you take the long view, though, this egalitarian impulse has been around for, you know, hundreds of years. It's the idea that, you know, the real problem between us is that we have these different religions governing different regions. And so we have religious wars. So if we just have a kind of a more pluralistic or, you know, to put the best in the best case scenario in the United States, or which I think did it probably the best, was a religious liberty of kinds where states can determine the boundaries of what religion, what religious activity is acceptable. But on the national level, there's no test for office, except I guess you do have to place your hand. I mean, it doesn't say on a Bible, but that would have been the understanding. The common law tradition was you did have to put your hand on a Bible and say, so it was still designed for Christians, but it was kind of a broadly Christian setting. And of course, over time, that's been eroded to the point that now it's just blatant religious anarchy. You're not allowed to even prefer in like town hall. You can't open with prayer hardly without getting a lawsuit now from the ACLU or something. But then, you know, after World War II, I think there was this understanding that developed that, well, it's not just religion, right? Religion was a problem. We had these disagreements and fought, but now it's the fact that we are different ethnically or racially. And those racial differences, if those are channeled into some kind of a nationalist fervor, or that you care too much about your people and place in a given area, then that'll create a war. And so to dilute that and to make sure that that threat never comes back, we need mass immigration. We need, I think that's probably part of, and I'm not against, just so people know, because I get these weird accusations of kinism come in, but like, I'm certainly not against interracial marriages, but I do think there is this weird push on the left that's, and then that explains it, why they want it so bad. You look at a McDonald's commercial I saw the other day, and like every family, you had like a black wife with a white husband with like a Asian kid, and it's like, you know, I don't even know like where are they getting this from. Like maybe there's like one family in my state that like might sort of approximate that through adoption or something, but it's just but that's their ideal, right? That's what they want to strive for. And I think it's because since World War II, it's like that won't produce conflict. We won't won't fight each other over these differences if we are all like kind of in this melting pot, this blender. And and so anyway, like you're saying that paleo conservatism, the old right, I was actually just reading an article from National Review from the 50s that was, I think it was Russell Kirk, but he was critiquing classical liberalism pretty hard. And so they some of those conservatives, they could see, and I think that is conservatism, like the even though it's not really an ism, the posture, the tradition, etc., has been to resist innovations and to try to maintain stability and social trust and identity, and realizing things that threaten those always produce negative consequences. So they stood opposed to the Nazis, they stood opposed to the communists, they stood opposed also though to the classical liberals. And and so but the classical liberals won the day, and that's what you're saying with the I guess, you know, neocon conservatives. And then you fast forward to where we are now, it's just that that's all taken for granted, like, and there's like a rewriting of history that like America has always been this classical liberal place. And what I see in the Christian nationals, and this is just my opinion, is that I think it's exactly what you're saying. It's a comeback of the paleo conservatism. And it's also, there may be in certain instances, some like theonomy and other stuff like mixed in there. But I think primarily, especially if you look at Stephen's book, this is a paleo conservatism that specifically arose from a Protestant political tradition. And it's been forgotten. And the people who claim to carry those doctrines in the realm of theology, and they're good on soteriology, and they're good on these other theological issues, they're not good on this. They're not good on public theology. And they don't go back and, I mean, they might mine for quotes in the 1689 or something. They try to find something that they can use to justify some kind of a neutrality, but that's not, but they have to mine. They're not reading it correctly. right? And so they're committed to this like post World War II consensus. And so anyway, I know I'm not going on my own rant that I've gone on for a while.
You're right. I mean, all of it. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you like what you said. The tell really is the commitment to the post-war consensus on politics and culture, the post-war globalist liberal democracy consensus. Because we had Nate Fisher on Contra Mundum last week, and he brought up a really good point that you have all of these guys, whether it's G3 or the late Tim Keller, or you have the Escondido people, like we're scary. Yes, we are very scary.
Yeah, I just showed some of the comments. No one wants to be the president. That's
cool. Yeah, no, absolutely not. I don't want to face 700 years in prison. You have all of these guys from very disparate traditions that are in conflict with each other. I mean, even have like Brian Mattson and Andrew Sandlin, who are theonomists or Bonsonites, that all of them are in agreement on Christian nationalism is bad and we can't have a Christian nation. They're all in agreement that the post-war consensus is good and it's inviolable. We cannot move away from it. And they'll all cobble together rationales from their disparate traditions to arrive at the same conclusion. So you'll have R. Scott Clark and Andrew Sandlin that are like doing the Predator handshake. Yeah, let's go to fight Christian nationalism or even if we don't use that phrase, to fight the way Christians believed about politics 100 years ago, all Christians everywhere, basically. And it's crazy to me, but it makes sense because that's the fundamental commitment, right? That's overarching over all their traditions. And all the major, major, very significant differences that they have in their political theology always comes back to, we can't move away from this, what we've had for the last 50 years.
Last question before your book. So this will be the determining factor as to whether you're scary or not. Do you think there should be any blasphemy laws of any kind?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not whether
you're scary.
Yeah, very scary. Right now we have guys who are going to prison because they burn rubber on a rainbow flag, right? We have blasphemy laws in America. You're always going to have them. And I mean, I saw in was it France or Great Britain that they're bringing back blasphemy laws against the Prophet Muhammad and Allah. You can't blaspheme, him. Right. And so you're always going to have these and there's certain things that a polity cannot allow. Right. You cannot. I mean, and it doesn't mean that you're not allowed to have a genuine, sincere opinion on religion where you don't believe in God. Right. I mean, you could be an atheist without blaspheming Jesus. Right. You can't. There's a distinction between sincere unbelief and provocative statements where you are attacking Christ, you're attacking the church, you're doing like the, what is it? The, where they put the crucifix in a jar of urine, things like that. You look back to throughout all of Christian history. I mean, even if you had a Baptist state, right, that was run by John Bunyan, right? Would they allow Piss Christ? Sorry for this is a family show, but that's the title of the piece. Would they allow that in their country? Of course they wouldn't.
Well, we had blasphemy laws on the books at the founding of the country, America. And they've just over time, and they were regional and state. They weren't on the national level, as far as I know. Yeah. But over time, those have been eroded. We also had anti-pornography laws up until even as late as the 70s and 80s. You could be arrested and go to jail if you had a picture of a naked woman in certain southern states. So. So this stuff is all been familiar. It's not, anti the people who think that's against the Constitution or something because it's against some notion of free speech they're misreading. I think that they're imposing upon the Constitution a newer understanding.
Yes, so. it's post civil rights revolution understanding of the Constitution. Like that's what I mean. Yeah. You look at like the James Lindsays and those people who are like, oh, the Constitution, it's like. Originally, man, the Constitution only let white men vote. Which Constitution are you talking about? Like, we got to respect the founders and everything. It's like, well, the Constitution they wrote is not one that you agree with. So, like, you know, which Constitution? And obviously they mean the Constitution after 1960 or after 1945, right? That's what they mean. And so, like, you go back, I mean, there are obvious, clear historical antecedents in American history where, yeah, they had blasphemy laws, they had anti-pornography laws. And that's one of the things where it's like, was America a Christian nation? Well, I mean, that's an indicator, right? That we were. And so, yeah, like, I mean, yeah, that's scary. But we're so far away from even like conceptualizing something like that. That's where I'm like, I'm hesitant to answer the question for that reason, because it's like, look, like we
we got like 10 other things we have to do.
Yeah, first. I mean, a million other things before we get there. Like, I would just like to not have these globalist wars that kill a million people and expend $1 trillion. Like, I would like to, you know, like, maybe take care of that first. I'd like to stop murdering, you know, a million babies a year, things like that. And then we can get to that point. So we're so far afield when we get to that. But I think it's good to raise that question, because it breaks the conceptual framework that people have, that this post-war consensus is sacrosanct, and we can't shake that up. Because when people talk about the Constitution, when you have like the, you know, the boomer cons, you know, the TPUSA types talk about, oh, the Constitution. Actually, you know, Charlie Kirk's been a lot better lately, but
he's improving. I've noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, it's something. But when they talk about, oh, the Constitution, we love the Constitution. They're talking about the 1960s Constitution. They're not talking about the Constitution before FDR, for sure. That's stuff that you have to break into and just force people outside the 3x5 card and thinking about things. You know,
certainly not pre-Lincoln. Yeah, it seems, because it's not. Yeah, it seems like it's like the Lincolnite. You could call it the Lincolnite Revolution. I coined that, so if anyone uses that, they have to pay me now. But you could call it that. You could say that, and then there was like a reprieve, sort of, and then when the Progressive Era came in, and then we had the Civil Rights constitutional understanding. Mm-hmm. You have kind of like two; they fit very well together. And so, the paleocons want to go pre-Lincoln, really, with their understanding. Yeah. They want more of an original understanding of it. But let's get into your book, because
we're 41 minutes in, and let's go.
we've been talking the entire podcast hasn't been about your book, but it's been interesting. That's Hopefully, people have enjoyed this. So the Boniface option, tell me about the book. Yeah. Who is Saint Boniface? What's the novel idea or I guess the strategy that you're recommending?
Yeah. Well, I'll correct it, at least the pronunciation I use and most Boniface.
Okay. So, well, there you go.
Yeah. There we go. So right off the bat, the Boniface option. I wrote the book.
Is it Augustine or Augustine?
Oh, that one is like, we're going to arm wrestle over that one. I think, it depends. Like, it's like the town in Florida is St. Augustine. I'm sure you probably hear me on podcasts. I'll say Augustine one time and Augustine another. So, you know, don't listen to me. But anyway, yeah, as far as the book goes, I wrote the book. I wrote an article, I think 2017, after Roger Ears' book came out about the Benedict option. I thought it was a pretty good book, but after finishing it, I thought, is that all there is? You know, just retreat to intentional community, intentional Christian community, and wait out the storm. Is that all we have left for us? Because there's a lot more going on than just that. We have bigger issues occurring, and I looked at I looked at it because, I mean, it's really the first salvo back within the Christian world, reacting to negative world, you know, going back to Wren's negative world. That was really the first big one, was Strier's book. And I'm like, that's not enough. There's got to be a lot more here that we have to dig into and get into. And so I was kind of disappointed in it, even though I generally liked it. And so what I wrote is that that's all retreating. And of course, in like terms of tactics and strategy in like a military sense, retreating is something you have to do sometimes, right? You have to retreat in order to live to fight another day. And so I, the people that were like, oh, it's just retreatist, it's terrible. I'm like, oh, no, I think there's some wisdom there, but there has to be more. There has to be going on offense, right? There has to be, all right, we're in the cloister hidden away, but that's not how Christendom was won in the first place. I mean, that's kind of the paradigm that he sets is like, well, the monasteries that were built up, that's what preserved Western civilization and allowed Christendom to flourish. And I'm like, yeah, on one hand, but then you also had men like Saint Boniface, and I get into the story in the early part of the book, where Saint Boniface was a Benedictine monk, right? He had taken the Benedict option. He was a Benedictine monk in England, and he was very, very skilled, very, very well thought of, very brilliant man, and was going to be made the abbot of his monastery, right? The head of his monastery, and have a very comfortable sinecure right there in England. And he rejected it. He said, no, I need to go to my people. He was a Saxon in England, and all these people that he's descended from in Germany are all still pagans. And he had a heart for his people, and he wanted to go there and bring Christ to them. He wanted to advance the borders of Christendom. And so he went, and one of the first things that he did was he went to the sacred shrine in what's now Geismar, Germany. And there was this huge oak tree that was the Oak of Thor, hundreds of years old. And this is where they did all of their pagan sacrifices and everything. And he shows up one day and tells them, I'm going to touch your tree. And not only am I going to touch, and they believe that if you touch the tree, Thor is going to send a lightning bolt from the heavens and strike you dead. And it's like, oh, these silly, superstitious pagan people. No, I actually believe that. Like, I believe that like Thor is a demon that has some power, and they worshiped him, and it probably really did happen. And so he's like, I'm going to not only touch it, I'm going to cut this thing down this time tomorrow. So word goes out through all the villages and everything that here's this Christian who's going to get fried tomorrow. Come watch. Let's watch this. This will be great. And so hundreds of people show up the next day to see him get, zapped. And he takes his axe, and as far as the legend goes, right, takes one swing, and a wind comes out of heaven and knocks the tree over. And everybody there that witnessed it that day confessed Christ and was baptized. And there the evangelization of Germany began. I mean, I'm German, and it's meaningful to me because, and I'm actually, my paternal ancestry comes from that region of Germany. And so it's very, very, very deep meaning for me personally. And it's this heroic story. I mean, later in his life, he was martyred by Frisians. And I mean, that's my actual ancestry is East Frisia. And it's like, wow, this is, he bled and died to bring Christ to my people. And so like, this is powerful, powerful stuff. And I'm like, and I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, and I'm looking around the landscape of American Christianity today, as I'm thinking about this story of reading Dreher's book in like 2017, I'm thinking, we don't have people like that. Right? We don't have any men like that at all that are just willing to go die or willing to suffer at least for the sake of Jesus Christ. And if anything, that's what we need, right? We need to build men like that. We need to become men like Saint Boniface. We need to become men that we had in earlier periods of Christendom. I mean, men like, I mean, you read the stories of the Reformation, you read like the biography of John Knox. And here's this man who's taken into slavery and is working in a galley slave rowing. I mean, just this, like, he's going to die doing this. And right. The Catholics make him kiss a, they're like, you have to go kiss this picture of Mary, and it comes to him and he throws the thing out of the boat. Right. And he could get beaten to death or whipped to death or whatever. And he doesn't care. Right. He's taking a stand for what he believes in. And I mean, all the men that were burned at the stake and I mean, Latimer and Ridley, like all of these stories. And it's like, we don't have anybody like that today. We're not like those men, but we need to be. And the moment has come, right? The moment has come where there is going to be real consequences for believing in Jesus in this insane world that we live in. And so right. The book is about that. I mean, the first half of the book is showing just how absolutely insane the world is that we live in. I call it, you know, trash world. It's an internet lingo. You know, it's trash world that we live in. And people, I mean, especially, you know, your typical evangelical pastor who's, you know, well-meaning guy. He loves his people. He wants to minister to them and disciple them and lead them to Jesus and all of that. And they're totally oblivious to how insane the world is. Like, they'll hear about the trans stuff and things like that, and they'll think it's this oddity, like, oh yeah, it's really bad out there. But they don't think any deeper about it than that. They don't think about how all of the insanity has been manufactured. All of it has been socially engineered to produce the kind of society that we have today. Right? People have intentionally built this world to be the way that it is, in order to de-Christianize it. Right, in order to strip away the Christian heritage that people had, the Christian culture that just pervaded everything. I mean, when we talk about some of the Christian nationalism stuff and nominal Christianity, and you'll have, you know, like the G3 type guys who are like, oh yeah, cultural Christianity is bad and it's good that it's gone. Or you know, Russell Moore talking about how Mayberry leads to hell just as surely as Gomorrah. And it's so stupid. Yeah. It's so dumb. I mean, when you think about it, because most people, right, most people that are in older days, who were Christians, you know, people who were Christians 100 years ago, they're Christians because all of the cultural, I mean, not only this, but all the cultural superstructure around them pushes it into them by osmosis. Everybody around them is a Christian, and yeah, you don't even have to think about it. Like culture, that's just how culture works. Is it's all the unstated stuff, right? The way the culture works is, It's the things that everybody implicitly agrees upon without even thinking, right? Without even, you know, because a lot of people think you just have to backfill every bit of Christian doctrine in order to be a Christian, right? You have to think through every kind of theology, every single thing. And most people aren't built for that. Not everybody is able to, you know, to read Calvin's Institutes and read Francis Turretin and read all of the great theological works and work through their theology that way. They just have a simple faith in Jesus where they're going to trust their leaders to lead them. That's how things work. And so anyway, like having a culture where the unstated agreement is that we're Christians, there's a Christian place, is good. It's very good. And what we have instead is a manufactured, socially engineered anti-Christian place. And it isn't just, it isn't just your religious expressions and things like that and things that you see on TV and all of that. It's the way that we live our life. It's not only anti-Christian, but it's anti-creational. And the obvious case is the trans stuff, where if you can attack the created order, right, to the extent that we don't know what a man and a woman is anymore, and strip that away. We don't know what a household is. We don't know what a father is. We've taken all of those things away and just stripped people down to mere individuals. That's an attack on God's creation, and it's an attack, on God's creation because they want to take away, you know, Christian life from people and any aspect of it in the world that people live in. And so some of it is just coming to grips with that, understanding that. Right. Once you wrap your head around those things, and really it's they want to make you this globalist, individualist consumer, right? Where all your life is you work and you consume stuff. You consume, you know, Disney and Marvel and Star Wars and NFL football and all the, you know, all of these, you know, accoutrements that mm-hmm. are around you. And that's what you live for. Right. You live to watch the Minnesota Vikings play. And that's your whole old purpose in life is to consume these things. It's like, oh man, I can't wait until the next episode of The Mandalorian. And like, that's your whole life. That's what you live for. And then you die. Right. And like, that's where they want people, because people like that are very, very easy to rule. People that don't have a people, they don't have a place. They don't have, They don't have any connection to the past. Like, that's why they strip away history and make it so that, I mean, you talk to people and they don't know any history before World War II, right? That's like the cutting off point. Is everything after World War II is real history. Everything before that is just bad and bigoted and evil, and everybody's bad and all of that. And so they want you cut off from those things. They want you to be totally deracinated and just these individuals that are, they're malleable and moldable. So they can rule you easily. And so when you talk about the, you know, what they're scared of, what they're threatened by, is they're threatened by a Christian people who are Christian all the way down to their bones, that have a connection to the millennia of Christian tradition and Christian history, and say, that's who I am. That's what my people are. And then, right, you can't manipulate them. You can't mold them. You can't shape them in this way anymore, because they're standing outside of this project that you have. And that's a huge threat. If your heart is with Jesus and everything that he's done and built and in our culture, within Christendom for 2000 years, it's hard to make a person just this globalist slave. It's very difficult. And so the book is about breaking people free from that, from trash world, and then building them up, right? Doing the things you must do in your own personal life to be a threat to this whole system. And it isn't, I mean, it's simple things. It's, I mean, I have a chapter on just like, they want you to be fat and weak and nearly dead. And so just being in good physical condition is, and lifting weights and eating well is, you know, a huge, you know, thumbing of your nose at this system. Right. And because it's completely outside, like the whole superstructure of it is like, just eat as much as you want, eat lots of carbs and, you know, keep drinking your big gulps. And because they want everyone to look like the people in Wall-E.
Do you think there is like somewhat like a Soros figure, World Economic Forum, kind of like a Klaus Schwab figure who really wants that? Or do you think that this is more like just kind of like natural, not natural, I don't want to say that, developments over time, that there's a benefit that a bigger government has when you are incapable of taking care of yourself. And so it's not like it's not like someone's going to sign on the dotted line, I want my citizens to be fat and like unable to take care of themselves, but it is like, it's not going to be discouraged, and it is, there are going to be mechanisms in place for encouraging it, just because it does not threaten the state, and it if anything, it gives more power to the state. Because I mean, that's how I see it. I don't know that there's like looming in the shadows some guy who wants everyone to be like, you know.
I don't think you can get like in these very conspiratorial mindsets. And it's not to say that there isn't like the World Economic Forum is not real, and that these figures are not pushing certain things. But a lot of it is just aligned with the kind of incentives that we have in this kind of globalist, fake capitalist system, not really free market system, but it's built to favor giant corporations. And so like in the system we have now, like healthcare, the healthcare industry is like almost a fifth of American GDP. So out of every dollar of goods and services that are produced in America, like 17 or 18 cents is healthcare, is insurance, is doctors, is pharmaceuticals, that kind of thing. And so there's an incentive there where it's like, if there's this cash cow where they kind of want you, they don't want you to be healthy because there's a lot of money in you being not healthy. Right. So there's this built-in incentive there that drives these things. Right. So it's just incentive structure. And same thing with like food, right. If they can produce this, corporate food system where they produce a lot of food, way more than we ever need to eat, but it's also not very sating. Right. So it's also like, there's a reason why like, Every kind of processed food is full of corn and soy oil and things like this, because one, we produce a lot of it, and we've designed a system to be able to like where I live, right? I go outside my door and I look and I see corn and soybeans everywhere. We manufacture a lot of that. And that kind of food, it doesn't fill you up. It makes you're still hungry after you eat it. Like you go to McDonald's and you drop $50 on McDonald's food, and 2 hours later you're hungry again, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is also, I think, by design, because it's like if you make food where you're still hungry afterward, then you're gonna spend more money on food. And so it's I think that's part of the somewhat part of it is like it's manufactured for profits, right? To keep the big line going up. And so I think a lot of it is that. So that is the incentive structure is aligned also with kind of the insidious political things where they all kind of fit together. I mean, it's like I don't know if you're familiar with like Moldbug, but I mean, he talks about like conspiracies are not just a handful of people sitting in a dark room, plotting evil stuff. I mean, not that those people don't exist, but it's really just this decentralized conspiracy theory. I mean, you look at, we're on YouTube, so I have to be careful of how I phrase this. I'll have to use coded language, but 2-3 years ago, you see it firsthand where it's not like every single doctor in America is in on the plot with Fauci, right? But the incentive structure is aligned for them to do whatever they say, right? And it's aligned for everybody to get a certain thing put in their arm, right? That's a lot of it. It isn't like there's this. I mean, there is a plot, but it's not. It's decentralized, right? Everybody knows their role in it, what they're supposed to do, and they go along with it, right? That's how it works. There's not any central figure pulling the strings. It's aligned with profit motive. It's aligned with certain political and cultural aspects that are unstated. I mean, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, that, when I talk about Trash World and being socially engineered and they want this, it's along those lines. It's not it's not so linear and so easy to like pin on. Well, if we just get rid of George Soros, then we're good. It's the entire superstructure of the whole regime and all of it. Right.
That's the boomer con mentality, right? Like that's what people typically, when they use that term, they're saying like, it's not the system that's the problem. It's the people running it. And if we just got rid of them, then
it's like Mike Pence at the debate last week, I don't know if you watched it, but he gets in with Vivek and he's like, Vivek's like, why are you doing all this Reaganite, mourning in America stuff? It is bad out there. What are you talking about? And he's like, Mike Pence, like, no, we just need a government as good as its people.
It's these platitudes that Mike Pence is so out of touch. It's unbelievable. He's been like that though for years.
Comical.
So, what do you think of this? Cause like, I don't like Christians who take offense at you somehow, thinking like you're doing this new novel thing. I don't see them like reaching back to Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson saying, and Francis Schaeffer too, I suppose you could say, but to say like those guys were really off the rails. Like those guys got us here. Yeah. Like they're not villains. And I'm wondering if part of the reason for that, in fact, I should say this. I've even seen people try to use like Francis Schaeffer against you guys, which to me is kind of unusual in a way, because I think Schaeffer would have been more on board probably with what you guys are trying to do. It's solely based on the fact that Schaeffer was worried about totalitarianism and they think that you're trying to promote totalitarianism. It's all based on that. It's like that's the whole justification for them calling you a bunch of Hegelians and like all the rest. Like it's that you want totalitarianism. You want what George Soros and the World Economic Forum want, but you just want a cross on the front of it and not right. So this veneer, this Christian veneer. And so I wonder though whether part of this problem has to do with like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell were trying to maintain something that was in danger of being lost, and it was being lost during their generation, and they wanted to like say that there's this moral majority out there who actually agrees with us, and we're not going to let that happen. So it was kind of a defensive maneuver. You could say the only aggressive stance they took was probably on abortion. Like we're going to overturn that, but that was something in such recent memory that it was like, it was trying to get back to something that everyone knew about. And it wasn't like a weird thing. Today though, 40 years later, you guys are basically saying you're not like doing a defensive position as much of like, we need to maintain what we have. It's more of, we need to actually aggressively take ground back that's been lost.
Yeah.
And so that's going to include sacrifices, and it's going to be a rough ride. Like, we're going to have to think outside the box. We're probably going to have like, funds set up to help people who are canceled in this process. Like, it's going to be, it's war basically. And it's, and we don't have the high ground anymore. We have to charge. And so that, I'm wondering if that's the main like distinction. There probably are others, but if that's like the thing that they're reacting to, like Christians, that's just not the way that I think many of us were told on a personal level Christians should ever act, right? We only can play defense. We can't really go, and we're not the type to go punch the bully in the nose. Like, that's not a Christian thing to do, really. We want to win that bully to Christ, kind of thing, right? You know what I mean? Like there is this, and we've had this confusion, I think, in us for years of like, like the ordinary, you know, sitting in the pew Christian thinks, well, yeah, we should be Christian, but also at the same time, we can't be aggressive about it. And here's these scary people who want to be aggressive, and that must be totalitarian. And so,
Do you
think that's the difference between you guys and what the 80s, what happened in the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 80s is, I think your read on it is right, that they saw that Christian America was being eroded and eaten away, and wanted to defend it, wanted to fight that process. And, you know, obviously you look at it, like, they failed, right? They did not accomplish what they set out to. And I think part of it is they did not full. I mean, we have the benefit of, you know, 30 or 40 years of hindsight that really it, what they needed to fight was the civil rights revolution. Because ultimately what that did was erode Christianity, I think. I mean, it's a culturally revolutionary act that took place. And they didn't wage a counter-revolution. They were just trying to maintain ground rather than aggressively attack, you know, the enemy that was destroying them. And today it's different, where we could just say it, that this was bad. It's destroyed us. And things, we have to change. We can't do the same thing that we've been doing for 40 years. We have to take a different strategy if we want to preserve the country that was given to us. It's funny, like, you bring up like being aggressive. The book is kind of a handbook of aggressive Christianity, if anything. My book, and I,
you kind of called it.
It's
that.
Funny.
The handbook of aggressive Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be another
Boniface option, you know, better.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. But it is, like, this Sunday I preached on, you know, 2 Samuel chapter 20. And that is, that's the chapter where you don't, unless you're like really deep into the story and the narrative of what's going on with King David. Like, David is old and weak and really impotent because of his sin and the consequences of his sin. And you have this really wicked nephew of his named Joab, who basically just takes over, right? He kills the guy that David replaces him with as head of the army, just kills him right in front of everybody, and goes and puts down a rebellion. And at the end of the chapter, right, it doesn't look like David's in charge. We're told that Joab is the commander of the army, and that's it. And the narrative picks up again in First Kings, where David has to tell Solomon, right, make Solomon his heir, and say, you got to take care of Joab. Right, that's the first order of business. And so really the point of that chapter is, if you have good men, right, faithful men who are weak, you are going, and they become weak and impotent, you're not going to have no men leading. You're going to have wicked men leading.
Right.
And what Israel needed was David, like he was before his sin. They needed a David that was aggressive, that would stand up to a 9-foot tall giant and say, you can't say that about my God. Let me kill him. Let me kill this giant. And you see it in Jesus. And I, you know, I'm like, you read the Gospels. I mean, you're told your whole life because of kind of a neutral world Christianity that Jesus was so sweet and kind and very winsome and very nice and gentle and patient. And he was very much like Mr. Rogers. You know, here comes, I'm taking my cardigan off and I'm untying my shoes and oh, here's the trolley. And like, that's the picture people have of Jesus. But you like actually read the Gospels, or you actually sit down and read them and you see a man who is bold. I mean, the boldest man in world history, right? He confronts his enemies. He verbally attacks them. It does not mince words at all. He calls them a brood of vipers and snakes and whitewashed tombs and all of that. And he utters woes against them. And you get to like Matthew, the end of the Gospel of Matthew. He goes into the heart of the temple, right? At Passover, when there's thousands of people there witnessing everything, and he attacks the priests. He calls this place a den of robbers, and he utters these woes and says, woe to you, woe to you, woe to you. And he knows what he is saying is going to cost him his life, right? That's what Jesus was like. That's the real Jesus. He was aggressive as all get out. And that's the Jesus that we need to see today and emulate and be like, not weak and wimpy and impotent and allowing Joabs to do everything, but rather aggressive, right? To confront things that are wrong, to attack, to challenge them. And it might, you know, there'll be losses. You might be martyred, or you might be virtually martyred. I mean, in our day, I mean, not that actual martyrdom is off the table, but we see this, like people will be canceled. You're not allowed to espouse, you know, basic Christian opinions. I mean, you have this thing in Ohio where this congressman attacks this pro-life leader for saying, you know, there's no hope outside of Jesus Christ. And he's like, that is the most bigoted and anti-Semitic thing I've ever heard. And of course he's forced to apologize, but not then he gets her, you know, essentially gets her fired.
Not a real apology. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I apologize for that. By the way, you're out of a job. You know, like that's what's going to happen to people who have any even like modicum of boldness with their Christian faith. Is you're going to be attacked. There's going to be a cost for being faithful and being bold, but you have to do it. We absolutely have to in order to you know, preserve our families, preserve our nation, all of this. So that's what we have to, God has to do in us, is see how insane the world is and be willing to say what is true and be bold about it and not mince words and say what we think and let the chips fall where they may, because people are not going to like you. That's like, you have to like that. I mean, that's part of the neutral world ethos, I think, is just get everybody to like you, right? If you're just nice and friendly, like, maybe they'll disagree with you about some stuff, but like, they're going to know that you're a really good person and that you're really nice, right? No, they're not going to, they're going to hate you. Like you need to come to grips with that. The fact that people are going to hate you, and they're going to hate you because of what you believe. And you have to be okay with that, right? You have to be, you know, I mean, I get this sometimes where people are like, well, where people will be like critical of me. They'll be like, well, I don't like any of the, you know, or so-and-so is, you know, says things better than you do, or like I get more out of Bible teaching from this other guy than you. And I'm like, well, why would I want you to like what I have to say? Like someone like I don't care about your opinion. I don't want, you know, like that's what people think. It's like, oh, if I say I don't like you, that's going to, you know, be a dagger to your heart and hurt you and make you feel.
Yeah, that is, you bring up something that is very weird. That's something.
I don't care about your opinion, you know.
Yeah, Josh Bice, when he emailed me back, you know, this was back in May. That's one of the things he said that I thought was interesting, was like, I've received basically negative messages about you from other people. And I'm like,
okay.
Like yeah, right? Like another day in my life. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just weird, especially for a Christian who follows a man who, obviously,
woe to you when all men think well of you. You know,
like, I mean, I could see if there's people who are godly and they're objecting to something you're saying, maybe pause yeah. and think through. Mm-hmm. Am I? But mm-hmm. but the using it as like almost like a tactic to I don't know, like that should be the goal, is to not have that. I don't even know exactly what's behind that, but there is something there that really bothered me, because it's not mm-hmm. just him. That's one example. This is like pervasive yeah. that. It's just really bad when other people mm-hmm. think negatively of you. And so, I mean, the way that I've, because yeah. they often justify it with like things like, yeah, but there's a qualification for an elder that you must be thought of kind of like well by the people yeah, that yeah. you're around outside the church. But I think the whole point of yeah. that is more like the people who actually see you outside of this performative environment where you are.
Yeah,
because it's easy for a pastor to just kind of be quote unquote godly or act that way with the stage mm-hmm. presence. I've seen that yep. many times. But the people who actually, like your neighbors, the people in your regular course of life, like they know you have a good character. You're not going to swindle yeah. them. You're not going to. Yeah. You're a good worker at if you had a secular job. Like mm-hmm. that's what that's talking about. It doesn't mean that they all yeah. just, you know, have the butterflies yeah. for you, or like, yeah. you know, they don't disagree with your Christianity, or you know, don't think you're a yeah. bigot somehow. So anyway,
yeah, exactly.
That's my rant.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I know people use that to be like that. See, there's a that's the elder qualification, is being winsome. And it's like, no, yeah. I mean, it's, I mean, we're in a time where, yeah. Or like not a brawler, you know, is part of it. And it's like, well, yeah, that's true. Like, you shouldn't be someone that's like looking for a fight always and just constantly on the warpath. And, you know, I tell people like all the time, I'm like, I actually don't want to fight. I don't want conflict. Right. I sure. will avoid it. I will avoid yeah. it if, like the plague, if I can. Like, I'm not looking to fight these people. And usually I only, you know, fight or argue if I'm being attacked. Like, I don't initiate it. Right. I don't go out of my way to, like, you know, attack different people, except for maybe like David French or Russell Moore. But I'm not looking to get into a spat with, you know, Jake Bedore or Alistair Roberts or any of the Davenant people. Right. You know, I'm not looking to like, I can't wait to wake up tomorrow and tweet a banger about these guys. Like, no, I'm not, I don't care about that. I don't want to fight. I want to encourage my people, in the way that they should go more than anything else. That's what I'm about. Yeah. I want, like, the fight is building up my people and backing them up, like having, you know, doing the things that I do, so they don't feel alone, right? Because that's a big thing, is all of these people are coming to grips with how insidious and destructive and evil and disgusting trash world is, and they see it all around them all day long, and there's this overwhelming feeling of that you're alone, you're the only one that thinks something is wrong, and yeah. I don't want our people to feel that way. I want them to know, like, no, you're right. Everything else, everybody else is nuts. You're the one that's sane, and keep doing what you're doing. Right. That's right. What I want to do, you know?
Yeah. Well, we should probably land the plane. We've been going about an hour and 16
yeah, we can
minutes,
keep going but... for a few hours here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. We could just, I'm sure there's tons next to talk time. About, but no, that sounds like a great message. And I really, you know, wish you success. I shouldn't say wish. I pray that you have success with your book and
yes,
with,
thank you.
With just the message that it conveys, and that, and, you know, I really hope that people take this to heart. This is the thing that I've also been, it's funny. I think many of us are seeing the same problem, and it's whether you want to call it Christian nationalism or masculine Christianity, or like you don't even have a label. You just like, I don't really, I just want to go back to like old, like conservatism. I don't want to let them take yeah. that word. That's my word. Like, that's,
oh, I know. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Whatever you want to think of it, like there is this need for a aggression of a masculine aggression mm-hmm. that seems to be nowhere. It seemed like mm-hmm. even in Hollywood this summer, you know, who the three biggest action movies were, who it was like Harrison Ford, Tom Cruise. Yeah, and yeah. I forget the name of the guy who plays in that that movie about child trafficking, but he's also kind of older.
Oh, Jim Caviezel. So, yeah.
Jim
yeah,
Caviezel.
Yeah.
So you have
they're
like
all over 50. Yeah,
they're all over 50. And then who yeah. do you have that's young? That's a young up. You have Ken in the Barbie movie.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. played by his 40s, you know.
Yeah, even okay.
Yeah.
So but still, yeah. there aren't any, even in Hollywood, you don't see positive examples of even pagans being masculine. Like,
yeah,
that's dying out. That's like the older generation of Hollywood. So
yeah,
it's just rich, and it needs to, like, that is the main need of the moment. So anyway, congratulations on, it's hard to complete a book. Congratulations on doing that. Yeah. Yeah, and people can get it where?
Right now on Amazon is the place to get it. I know a lot of people hate Amazon. I'm not particularly fond of Amazon either. But it's the most efficient and easiest way to get it out there and keep it out in the public eye. So yeah, if you go to BonifaceOption.com, they'll take you right to the link to get the book. And yeah, please pick it up and read it. Share it with people. I know a lot of people I'm so blown away that people really like it. Cause you know, you write something and anybody that, even if you write blog posts and things like that, you're like, is anybody going to read this? You know, is it going to be, you know, are they going to like what I'm writing or is it going to have any impact at all? And yeah, so you do it and you hope for the best. And the messages I've received from so many people are like, you know, I've followed, you know, what you've done for years. And I had high expectations for the book and it blew away all my expectations. And right. And that like means a lot. I mean, it really, really does. When people that said, I had high hopes for the book and you exceeded all of them, you know, that's really saying something. So, I mean, you read it. I think a lot of people really get a lot out of it. And I mean, I wrote it for, you know, our kind of people, for people like your audience, that need support and encouragement and to be built up. And I also wrote it for, you know, the kind of Christians who have never thought about any of this stuff, to kind of like, you know, wake them up, you know, give them a sort of red pill moment. Yeah. And see that things are bad. And I even wrote it also for the kind of guys who are in middle America, who are not really church going guys, who are not not even, you know, they would say they believe in God or believe in Jesus, but I mean, the kind of people that, like, they hear Oliver Anthony's song and they're like, yeah, that's great. It's for those type of folks that, I mean, their experience in church has been what we've been talking about, where it's just this really wimpy, very consumeristic, religious expression, where it's just, you know, it's just entertainment and it's kind of more or less meaningless. And they've never seen any kind of aggressive masculine Christianity that's like, that's what I want. I mean, you see like Oliver Anthony read Psalm 37 and people are like, yeah, let's go, you know, like, and it's like, I want people like that, you know, people that they hear that and they're like, yes. Right. They just read an imprecatory psalm and they're like, yes.
I know. It's crazy.
You know,
it's crazy.
I want them to read the book and think, oh, there's a kind of Christianity out there that speaks to me. You know, that's what I'm trying to produce and bring people to, because it's lacking. It doesn't really exist, but it can still. And the kind of Christian faith that built the world that we love, is just a little bit of an ember right there. But I want it to turn back into a roaring fire.
Yeah. Living in the new world with an old soul. Andrew Isker on the Conversations That Matter podcast. You can check out the book on Amazon, The Boniface Option. Check it out. God bless. Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, John.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.